get out my pocket knife to slit it open. 3 sheets of paper from a 5-cent lined school pad, written on with a soft lead pencil. A will. I, being in my right mind, and, in consideration, I... A note of hand. I agree to repay and pledge my... Both papers signed, the writing neat and precise. Dear Eth, this is what you want. The skin on my face felt as hard as a crab's back. I closed the alley door slowly, as you'd close a vault. The first 2 sheets of paper I folded carefully and placed in my wallet, and the other, I crumpled it and put it in the toilet and pulled the chain. It's a high box toilet with a kind of step in the bowl. The balled paper resisted going over the edge, but it finally did. The alley door was a little open when I emerged from the cubicle. I thought I'd closed it. Going toward it, I heard a small sound, and, looking up, I saw that damn cat on one of the top storage shelves hooking out with its claws for a hanging side of bacon. It took a long-handled broom and quite a chase to drive it out into the alley. As it streaked past me, I swiped at it and missed and broke the broom handle against the door jamb. There was no sermon for the canned goods that morning. I couldn't raise a text. But I did get out a hose and wash down the front sidewalk and the gutter, too. Afterward, I cleaned the whole store, even corners long neglected and choked with flug. And I sang, too. Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. I know it's not a song, but I sang it. Part 2. Chapter 11. New Baytown is a lovely place. Its harbor, once a great one, is sheltered from the northeast screamers by an offshore island. The village is strewn about a complex of inland waters, fed by the tides, which at ebb and flow drive wild races through narrow channels from the harbor and the sea. It is not a crowded or an urban town. Except for the great houses of the long-gone whalers, the dwellings are small and neat, distributed among fine old trees, oaks of several kinds, maples and elms, hickories and some cypresses. But except for the old planted elms on the original streets, the native timber is largely oak. Once the virgin oaks were so many and so large that several shipyards drew planks and knees, keels and keelsons from nearby. Communities, like people, have periods of health and times of sickness, even youth and age, hope and despondency. There was a time when a few towns like New Baytown furnished the whale oil that lighted the Western world. Student lamps of Oxford and Cambridge drew fuel from this American outpost. And then petroleum, rock oil, gushed out in Pennsylvania, and cheap kerosene, called coal oil, took the place of whale oil and retired most of the sea hunters. Sickness or despair fell on New Baytown, perhaps an attitude from which it did not recover. Other towns, not too far away, grew and prospered on other products and energies, but New Baytown, whose whole living force had been in square-rigged ships and whales, sank into torpor. The snake of population crawling out from New York passed New Baytown by, leaving it to its memories. And as usually happens, New Baytown people persuaded themselves that they liked it that way. They were spared the noise and litter of summer people, the garish glow of neon signs, the spending of tourist money and tourist razzle-dazzle. Only a few new houses were built around the fine inland waters. But the snake of population continued to writhe out, and everyone knew that sooner or later it would engulf the village of New Baytown. The local people longed for that and hated the idea of it at the same time. The neighboring towns were rich, spilled over with loot from tourists, puffed with spoils, gleamed with the great houses of the new rich. Old Baytown spawned art and ceramics and pansies, and the damn broad-footed brood of Lesbos wove handmade fabrics and small domestic intrigues. New Baytown talked of the old days, and of flounder, and when the weak fish would start running. In the reedy edges of the inner waters, the mallards nested and brought out their young flotillas. Muskrats dug communities and swam lithely in the early morning. The ospreys hung, aimed, and plummeted on fish, and seagulls carried clams and scallops high in the air and dropped them to break them open for eating. Some otters still clove the water like secret furry whispers. Rabbits poached in the gardens, and gray squirrels moved like little waves in the streets of the village. Cock pheasants flapped and coughed their crowing. Blue herons poised in the shallow water like leggy rapiers, and at night the bitterns cried out like lonesome ghosts. Spring is late, and summer late at New Baytown, but when it comes it has a soft, wild, and special sound and smell and feeling. In early June the world of leaf and blade and flowers explodes, and every sunset is different. Then in the evening the bobwhites state their crisp names, and after dark there is a wall of sound of whippoorwill. The oaks grow fat with leaf and fling their long tasseled blossoms in the grass. Then dogs from various houses meet and go on picnics, wandering bemused and happy in the woods, and sometimes they do not come home for days. In June, man, hustled by instinct, mows grass, riffles the earth with seeds, and locks in combat with mole and rabbit, ant, beetle, bird, and all others who gather to take his garden from him. Woman looks at the curling-edged petals of a rose, and melts a little in size, and her skin becomes a petal, and her eyes are stamens. June is gay, cool and warm, wet and shouting with growth and reproduction of the sweet and the noxious, the builder and the spoiler. The girls in body-form slacks wander the high street with locked hands, while small transistor radios sit on their shoulders and whine love songs in their ears. The young boys, bleeding with sap, sit on the stools of Tanger's drugstore, ingesting future pimples through straws. They watch the girls with level goat eyes and make disparaging remarks to one another while their insides whimper with longing. In June, businessmen drop by Al and Sue's, or the Foremaster for a beer, and stay for whiskey, and get sweatily drunk in the afternoon. Even in the afternoon, the dusty cars creep the desolate dooryard of the remote and paintless house with every blind drawn, at the end of Mill Street, where Alice, the village whore, receives the afternoon problems of June-bitten men. And all day long the rowboats anchor off the breakwater, and happy men and women coax up their dinners from the sea. June is painting and clipping, plans and projects. It's a rare man who doesn't bring home cement blocks and two-by-fours, and on the backs of envelopes rough-out drawings of Taj Mahals. 100 little boats lie belly down and keel up on the shore, their bottoms gleaming with copper paint, and their owners straighten up and smile at the slow, unmoving windrows. Still school grips the intransigent children until near the end of the month, and, when examination time comes, rebellion foams up and the common cold becomes epidemic, a plague which disappears on closing day. In June the happy seed of summer germinates. Where shall we go over the glorious 4th of July? It's getting on time we should be planning our vacation. June is the mother of potentials. Ducklings swim bravely, perhaps to the submarine jaws of snapping turtles. Lettuces lunge toward drought. Tomatoes rear defiant stems toward cutworms. And families match the merits of sand and sunburn over fretful mountain nights loud with mosquito symphonies. This year I'm going to rest. I won't get so tired. This year I won't allow the kids to make my free 2 weeks a hell on wheels. I work all year. This is my time. I work all year. Vacation planning triumphs over memory, and all's right with the world. New Baytown had slept for a long time. The men who governed it, politically, morally, economically, had so long continued that their ways were set. The town manager, the council, the judges, the police were eternal. The town manager sold equipment to the township. And the judges fixed traffic tickets as they had for so long that they did not remember it as illegal practice. At least the books said it was. Being normal men, they surely did not consider it immoral. All men are moral. Only their neighbors are not. The yellow afternoon had the warm breath of summer. A few early season people, those without children to hold them glued until school was out, were moving in the streets, strangers. Some cars came through, towing small boats and big outboard motors on trailers. Ethan would have known with his eyes closed that they were summer people by what they bought. Cold cuts and processed cheese, crackers and tinned sardines. Joey Morphy came in for his afternoon refreshment, as he did every day now that the weather was warming. He waved the bottle toward the cold counter. "You should put in a soda fountain," he said, "and grow 4 new arms, or split into 2 clerks like a pseudopod. You forget, neighbor Joey, I don't own the store." "You should. Must I tell you my sad story of the death of kings?" "I know your story. You didn't know your asparagus from a hole in the double-entry bookkeeping. You had to learn the hard way. Now wait. But you learned." "Small good it does me." "If it was your store now, you'd make money." "But it isn't." "If you opened up next door, you'd take all the customers with you."
"What makes you think so?"
"Because people buy from people they know. It's called goodwill, and it works."
"It didn't work before. Everybody in town knew me. I went broke."
"That was technical. You didn't know how to buy."
"Maybe I still don't."
"You do. You don't even know you've learned. But you've still got a broke state of mind. Junk it, Mr. Hawley. Junk it, Ethan."
"Thanks."
"I like you. When is Marullo going to Italy?"
"He hasn't said."
"Tell me, Joey, how rich is he?"
"No, don't. I know you're not supposed to talk about clients."
"I can rupture a rule for a friend, Ethan. I don't know all his affairs, but if our account means anything, I'd say he is. He's got his fingers in all kinds of things. Piece of property here, vacant lot there, some beachfront houses, and a bundle of first mortgages big around as your waist."
"How do you know?"
"Safe deposit box. He rents one of our big ones. When he opens it, he has one key and I have the other. I'll admit, I've peeked. Guess I'm a peeping Tom at heart.
But it's all on the level, isn't it? I mean, well, you read all the time about, well, drugs and rackets and things like that."
"I wouldn't know about that. He don't tell his business around. Draws some out, puts some back. And I don't know where else he banks. You notice I don't tell his balance."
"I didn't ask.
Could you let me have a beer?"
"Only to take out. I can put in a paper cup."
"I wouldn't ask you to break the law."
"Nuts." Ethan punched holes in a can. "Just hold it down beside you if anybody comes in."
"Thanks. I've put a lot of thought on you, Ethan."
"Why?"
"Maybe because I'm a nosy Parker. Failure is a state of mind. It's like one of those sand traps and ant lion digs. You keep sliding back. Takes one hell of a jump to get out of it. You've got to make that jump, Eth. Once you get out, you'll find success is a state of mind, too."
Is it a trap, too? If it is, it's a better kind. Suppose a man makes the jump and someone else gets tromped. Only God sees the sparrow fall, but even God doesn't do anything about it. I wish I knew what you're trying to tell me to do. I wish I did, too. If I did, I might do it myself. Bank tellers don't get to be president. A man with a fistful of stock does. I guess I'm trying to say, grab anything that goes by. It may not come around again. You're a philosopher, Joey, a financial philosopher. Don't rub it in. If you don't have it, you think about it. Man being alone thinks about things. You know, most people live 90% in the past, 7% in the present, and that only leaves them 3% for the future. Old Satchel Paige said the wisest thing about that I ever heard. He said, "Don't look behind. Something may be gaining on you." I gotta get back. Mr. Baker's going to New York tomorrow for a few days. He's as busy as a bug. What about? How do I know? But I separate the mail. He's been getting a lot from Albany. Politics? I only separate it. I don't read it. Is business always this slow? Around 4 o'clock, yes. It'll pick up in 10 minutes or so. You see? You've learned. I bet you didn't know that before you went broke. Be seeing you. Grab the gold ring for a free ride. The little buying spurt between 5 and 6 came on schedule. The sun, held back by daylight saving, was still high and the streets light as mid-afternoon when he brought in the fruit bins and closed the front doors and drew the green shades. Then, reading from a list, he gathered the supplies to carry home and put them all in one big bag. With his apron off and his coat and hat on, he boosted up and sat on the counter and stared at the shelves of the congregation. "No message," he said. "Only remember the words of Satchel Paige. I guess I have to learn about not looking back." He took the folded line pages from his wallet, made a little envelope for them of waxed paper. Then, opening the enamel door of the works of the cold counter, he slipped the waxy envelope in a corner behind the compressor and closed the metal door on it. Under the cash register on a shelf he found the dusty and dog-eared Manhattan telephone book, kept there for emergency orders to the supply house. Under U, under United States, under Justice Department of. His finger moved down the column past Antitrust Division, U.S. Courthouse, Customs Division, Detention Headquarters, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and under it, Immigration and Naturalization Service, 20 West Broadway, BA7-0300, nights, Saturday, Sunday, and holidays, OL6-5888. He said aloud, OL6-5888. OL6-5888, because it's late. And then he spoke to his canned goods without looking at them. If everything's proper and above board, nobody gets hurt. Ethan went out the alley door and locked it. He carried his bag of groceries across the street to the Four Master Hotel and Grill. The grill was noisy with cocktailers, but the tiny lobby where the public phone booth stood was deserted, even by the room clerk. He closed the glass door, put his groceries on the floor, spread his change on the shelf, inserted a dime and dialed 0.
"Operator?"
"Oh, operator. I want to call New York.
Will you dial the number, please?"
And he did. Ethan came from work carrying his bag of groceries. How good the long afternoons are. The lawn was so tall and lush that it took his footprints. He kissed Mary damply. "Pollywog," he said. "The lawn is running wild. Do you think I could get Alan to cut it?"
"Well, it's examination time. You know how that is. And school's closing and all."
"What's that unearthly squalling sound in the other room?"
"He's practicing with his voice-throwing gadget. He's going to perform at the school closing show."
"Well, I guess I'll have to cut the lawn myself."
"I'm sorry, dear, but you know how they are."
"Yes, I'm beginning to learn how they are."
"Are you in a bad temper?" Did you have a hard day?
Let's see. No, I guess not. I've been on my feet all day. The thought of pushing the lawnmower doesn't make me jump with joy.
We should have a power mower. The Johnsons have one you can ride on.
We should have a gardener and a gardener's boy. My grandfather did.
Ride on?
Well, Alan might cut the lawn if he could ride.
Don't be mean to him. He's only 14. They're all like that.
Who do you suppose established the fallacy that children are cute?
You are in a bad temper.
Let's see. Yes, I guess I am. And that squalling is driving me crazy.
He's practicing.
So you said.
Now, don't take your bad temper out on him.
All right, but it would help if I could.
Ethan pushed through the living room where Alan was squawking vaguely recognizable words from a vibrating reed held on his tongue.
What in the world is that?
Alan spat it into his palm. From that box of peaks, it's ventriloquism.
Did you eat the peaks?
No, I don't like it. I've got to practice, Dad.
Hold up a moment. Ethan sat down. What do you plan to do with your life?
Huh?
The future. Haven't they told you in school? The future's in your hands.
Ellen slithered into the room and draped herself on the couch like a knob-kneed cat. She rippled out a steel-cutting giggle.
He wants to go on television, she said.
There was a kid only 13 won $130,000 on a quiz program.
Turned out it was rigged, said Ellen.
Well, he still had $130,000. Ethan said softly. The moral aspects don't bother you?
Well, it's still a lot of dough.
You don't find it dishonest?
Shucks, everybody does it.
How about the ones who offer themselves on a silver platter and they're no takers? They have neither honesty nor money.
That's a chance you take. The way the cookie crumbles.
Yes, it is crumbling, isn't it? Ethan said. And so are your manners. Sit up. Have you dropped the word sir from the language?
The boy looked startled, checked to see if it was meant, then lounged upright, full of resentment.
No, sir, he said. How are you doing in school?
All right, I guess.
You were writing an essay about how you love America. Has your determination to destroy or stop that project?
How do you mean destroy, sir?
Can you honestly love a dishonest thing?
Heck, Dad, everybody does it.
Does that make it good?
Well, nobody's knocking it except for a few eggheads. I finished the essay.
Good. I'd like to see it.
I sent it off.
You must have a copy.
No, sir.
Suppose it gets lost.
I didn't think of that. Dad, I wish I could go to camp the way all the other kids do.
We can't afford it. Not all the other kids go, only a few of them.
I wish we had some money.
He stared down at his hands and licked his lips. Ellen's eyes were narrowed and concentrated. Ethan studied his son.
I'm going to make that possible, he said.
Sir?
I can get you a job to work in the store this summer.
How do you mean work?
Isn't your question, what do you mean work? You will carry and trim shelves and sweep, and perhaps, if you do well, you can wait on customers.
I want to go to camp.
You also want to win $100,000.
Maybe I'll win the essay contest. At least that's a trip to Washington, anyway. Some kind of vacation after all year in school.
Alan, there are unchanging rules of conduct, of courtesy, of honesty, yes, even of energy. It's time I taught you to give them lip service, at least. You're going to work.
The boy looked up.
You can.
I beg your pardon?
Child labor laws. I can't even get a work permit before I'm 16. You want me to break the law?
Do you think all the boys and girls who help their parents are half slave and half criminal?
Ethan's anger was as naked and ruthless as love.
Alan looked away. I didn't mean that, sir.
I'm sure you didn't. And you won't again. You stubbed your nose on 20 generations of Hawleys and Allens. They were honorable men. You may be worthy to be one someday.
Yes, sir. May I go to my room, sir?
You may.
Allen walked up the stairs slowly. When he had disappeared, Ellen whirled her legs like propellers. She sat up and pulled down her skirt like a young lady.
I've been reading the speeches of Henry Clay. He sure was good.
Yes, he was.
Do you remember them?
Not really, I guess. It's been a long time since I read them.
He's great.
Somehow it doesn't seem schoolgirl reading.
He's just great.
Ethan got up from his chair with a whole long and weary day pushing him back. In the kitchen, he found Mary red-eyed and angry.
I heard you, she said. I don't know what you think you're doing. He's just a little boy.
That's the time to start, my darling.
Don't darling me. I won't stand a tyrant.
Tyrant? Oh, Lord.
He's just a little boy. You went for him.
I think he feels better now.
I don't know what you mean. You crushed him like an insect.
No, darling. I gave him a quick glimpse of the world. He was building a false one.
Who are you to know what the world is?
Ethan walked past her and out the back door.
Where are you going?
Cut the lawn.
I thought you were tired.
I am. I was. He looked over his shoulder and up at her standing inside the screen door. A man is a lonely thing, he said. And he smiled at her a moment before he got out the lawnmower. Mary heard the whirring blades tearing through the soft and supple grass. The sound stopped by the doorstep. Ethan called, Mary, Mary, my darling, I love you. And the whirling blades raged on through the overgrown grass.
Chapter 12.
Margie Young Hunt was an attractive woman, informed, clever. So clever that she knew when and how to mask her cleverness. Her marriages had failed, the men had failed. One by being weak, and the second, weaker, he died. Dates did not come to her. She created them, mended her fences by frequent telephone calls, by letters, get-well cards, and arranged accidental meetings. She carried homemade soup to the sick and remembered birthdays. By these means, she kept people aware of her existence. More than any woman in town, she kept her stomach flat, her skin clean and glowing, her teeth bright, and her chin line taut. A goodly part of her income went to hair, nails, massage, creams, and unguents. Other women said, she must be older than she looks. When supporting muscles of her breasts no longer responded to creams, massage, and exercise, she placed them in shapely forms that rode high and jauntily. Her makeup took increasing time. Her hair had all the sheen, luster, wave the television products promise. On a date, dining, dancing, laughing, amusing, drawing her escort with a net of small magnets, who could know her cold sense of repetition? After a decent interval and an outlay of money, she usually went to bed with him, if she discreetly could. Then, back to her fence mending. Sooner or later, the shared bed must be the trap to catch her future security and ease. But the prospective game leapt clear of the quilted jaws. More and more of her dates were the married, the infirm, or the cautious. And Margie knew better than anyone that her time was running out. The tarot cards did not respond when she sought help for herself. Margie had known many men, most of them guilty, wounded in their vanity, or despairing, so that she had developed a contempt for her quarry, as a professional hunter of vermin does. It was easy to move such men through their fears and their vanities.
They ached so to be fooled that she no longer felt triumph, only a kind of disgusted pity. These were her friends and associates. She protected them even from the discovery that they were her friends. She gave them the best of herself because they demanded nothing of her. She kept them secret because at the bottom, she did not admire herself. Danny Taylor was one of these, and Alfio Marullo another, and Chief Stonewall Jackson Smith a third, and there were others. They trusted her and she them, and their secret existence was the one warm honesty to which she could retire to restore herself. These friends talked freely and without fear to her, for to them she was a kind of Anderson's Well, receptive, unjudging, and silent. As most people have secret vices, Margie Young Hunt concealed a secret virtue. And because of this quiet thing, it is probable that she knew more about New Baytown and even Wessex County than anyone, and her knowledge was unwarped because she would not, could not, use it for her own profit. But in other fields, everything that came to her hand was usable. Her project, Ethan Allen Hawley, began casually and out of idleness. In a way, he was correct in thinking it was mischievous, a testing of her power. Many of the sad men who came to her for comfort and reassurance were hog-tied with impotence, bound and helpless in sexual traumas that infected all other areas of their lives. And she found it easy by small flatteries and reassurances to set them free, to fight again against their whip-armed wives. She was genuinely fond of Mary Hawley, and through her she gradually became aware of Ethan, bound in another kind of trauma, a social, economic bind that had robbed him of strength and certainty. Having no work, no love, no children, she wondered whether she could release and direct this crippled man towards some new end. It was a game, a kind of puzzle, a test, a product not of kindness, but simply of curiosity and idleness. This was a superior man. To direct him would prove her superiority, and this she needed increasingly. Probably she was the only one who knew the depth of the change in Ethan, and it frightened her because she thought it was her doing. The mouse was growing a lion's mane. She saw the muscles under his clothes, felt ruthlessness growing behind his eyes. So must the gentle Einstein have felt when his dreamed concept of the nature of matter flashed over Hiroshima. Margie liked Mary Hawley very much, and she had little sympathy and no pity for her. Misfortune is a fact of nature acceptable to women, especially when it falls on other women. In her tiny, immaculate house, set in a large, overgrown garden very near to Old Harbor, she leaned toward the makeup mirror to inspect her tools, and her eyes saw through cream, powder, eyeshadowing, and lashes sheathed in black, saw the hidden wrinkles, the inelasticity of skin. She felt the years creep up, like the rising tide about a rock in a calm sea. There is an arsenal of maturity, of middle age, but these require training and technique she did not yet have. She must learn them before her structure of youth and excitement crumbled and left her naked, rotten, ridiculous. Her success had been that she never let down, even alone. Now, as an experiment, she allowed her mouth to droop as it wanted to, her eyelids to fall half-staff. She lowered her high-held chin, and a plaited rope came into being. Before her in the mirror she saw 20 years clamber over her, and she shuddered as the icy whispering told her what lay waiting. She had delayed too long. A woman must have a showcase in which to grow old, lights, props, black velvet, children, graying and fattening, snickering and pilfering, love, protection, and small change, a serene and undemanding husband, or his even more serene and less demanding will and trust fund.
A woman growing old alone is useless, cast-off trash, a wrinkled obscenity with no hobbled retainers to cluck and mutter over her aches and to rub her pains. A hot spot of fear formed in her stomach. She had been lucky in her first husband. He was weak, and she soon found the valve of his weakness. He was hopelessly in love with her, so much so that when she needed a divorce, he did not ask for a remarriage clause in his alimony settlement. Her second husband thought she had a private fortune, and so she had. He didn't leave her much when he died, but with the alimony from her first husband, she could live decently, dress well, and cast about at leisure. Suppose her first husband should die. There was the fear spot. There was the night or daymare, the monthly check mare. In January, she had seen him at that great wide cross of Madison Avenue and 57th Street. He looked old and gaunt. She was haunted with his mortality. If the bastard died, the money would stop. She thought she might be the only person in the world who wholeheartedly prayed for his health. His lean, silent face and dead eyes came on her memory screen now and touched off the hot spot in her stomach. If the son of a bitch should die! Margie, leaning toward the mirror, paused and hurled her will like a javelin. Her chin rose. The ropes dropped back. Her eyes shone. The skin snuggled close to her skull. Her shoulders squared. She stood up and waltzed in a deft circle on the deep-piled red carpet. Her feet were bare, with gleaming, pinkened toenails. She must rush, she must hurry, before it was too late. She flung open her closet and laid hands on the sweet, provocative dress she had been saving for the 4th of July weekend, the shoes with pencil heels, the stockings more sheer than no stockings at all. There was no languor in her now. She dressed as quickly and efficiently as a butcher wets his knife, and she checked against a full-length mirror the way the same butcher tests his blade against his thumb. Speed, but no rush. Speed for the man who will not wait, and then the casual slowness of the informed, the smart, the chic, the confident, the lady with pretty legs and immaculate white gloves. No man she passed failed to look after her. Miller Brothers' truck driver whistled as he lumbered by with lumber, and two high school boys leveled slitted Valentino eyes at her and painfully swallowed the saliva that flooded their half-open mouths. "How about that one?" said one. And, "Yeah," the other replied. "How'd you like, yeah?" A lady does not wander, not in New Baytown. She must be going someplace, have some business, however small and meaningless. As she walked in dotted steps along the high street, she bowed and spoke to passers-by and reviewed them automatically. Mr. Hall. He was living on credit, had been for some time. Stoney. A tough mailman. But what woman could live on a cop salary or pension? Besides, he was her friend. Harold Beck, with real estate and plenty of it, but Harold was queer as a duck. He himself was probably the only person in the world who didn't know it. McDowell. "So nice to see you, sir. How's Millie?" Impossible. Scottish, tight, tied to his wife. An invalid, the kind who lives forever. He was a secret. No one knew what he was worth. Dew-eyed Donald Randolph. Wonderful on the next bar stool, a barroom gentleman whose manners penetrated deep into his drunkenness, but useless unless you wanted to keep house on a bar stool. Harold Luce. It was said that he was related to the publisher of Time magazine, but who said it? Himself? A flinty man who had a reputation for wisdom based on his lack of the power of speech. Ed Wantoner. A liar, a cheat, and a thief. Supposed to be loaded, and his wife was dying, but Ed trusted no one. He didn't even trust his dog not to run away, kept him tied up and howling. Paul Strait, a power in the Republican Party. His wife was named Butterfly. Not a nickname. Butterfly Strait. Christened Butterfly, and that's the truth. Paul did well if New York State had a Republican governor. He owned the city dump, where it cost a quarter to dump a load of garbage. It was told that when the rats got so bad and big as to be dangerous, Paul sold tickets for the privilege of shooting them, rented flashlights and rifles, stocked 22 caliber cartridges to shoot them with. He looked so like a president that many people called him Ike. But Danny Taylor, while quietly drunk, had referred to him as the noblest Paul of them all. And that stuck. Noble Paul became his nickname when he wasn't present. Marullo. He's sicker than he was. He's gray sick. Marullo's eyes were those of a man shot in the stomach with a 45. He had walked past the doorway of his own store without going in. Margie entered the store, bouncing her neat buttocks. Ethan was talking to a stranger, a youngish, dark-haired man, Ivy League pants and hat with a narrow brim. 40-ish, hard, tough, and devoted to whatever he was doing. He leaned over the counter and seemed about to inspect Ethan's tonsils. Margie said, "Hi, you're busy. I'll come back later." There are endless idle but legitimate things a strolling woman can do in a bank. Margie crossed the alley mouth and went into the marble and brushed steel temple. Joey Morphy lighted up the whole barred square of his teller's window when he saw her. What a smile. What a character. What a good playmate. And what a lousy prospect as a husband. Margie properly appraised him as a born bachelor who would die fighting to remain one. No double grave for Joey. She said, "Please, sir, do you have any fresh unsalted money?" "Excuse me, ma'am, I'll see. I'm almost positive I saw some somewhere. How much of it would you like to have?" "About 6 ounces, monsieur." She took a folding book from her white kid bag and wrote a check for $20. Joey laughed. He liked Margie. Once in a while, not too often, he took her out to dinner and later. But he also liked her company and her sense of play. Joey said, "Mrs. Young Hunt, that reminds me of a friend I had who was in Mexico with Pancho Villa. Remember him?"
"Never knew him."
"No jazz. It's a story a guy told me. He said when Pancho was in the North, he worked the mint printing, 20 peso notes. Made so many his men stopped counting them. They weren't so hot at counting anyway. Got to weighing them on a balance scale." Margie said,
"Joey, you can't resist autobiography."
"Hell no, Mrs. Young Hunt. I'd have been about 5 years old. It's a story. Seems a fine stacked dame, Injun but stacked, came in and said, 'My general, you have executed my husband and left me a poor widow with 5 children. And is that any way to run a popular revolution?' So Pancho went over her assets, the way I'm doing now."
"You've got no mortgage, Joey."
"I know. It's a story. Pancho said to an aide-de-camp, 'Weigh out 5 kilos of money for her.' Well, that's quite a bundle. They tied it together with a piece of wire, and the woman went out, dangling the bale of kale. Then a lieutenant stepped out and saluted, and he said, 'Mi general, we did not shoot her husband. He was drunk. We put him in jail around the corner.' Pancho had never taken his eyes off the dame walking away with the bundle. He said, 'Go out and shoot him. We cannot disappoint that poor widow.'"
"Joey, you're impossible."
"It's a true story. I believe it." He turned her check around. "Do you want this in 20s, 50s, or 100s?
"Give it to me in 2 bitses.
They enjoyed each other. Mr. Baker looked out of his frosted glass office. Now there was a bet. Baker had made a grammatically correct but obscure passeter once. Mr. Baker was Mr. Money. Sure, he had a wife, but Margie knew the Bakers of this world. They could always raise a moral reason for doing what they wanted to do anyway. She was glad she had turned him down. It left him still in the book. She gathered the $4 or $5 bills Joey had given her and moved toward the gray banker. But at that moment, the man she'd seen talking to Ethan came in quietly. passed in front of her, presented a card, and was taken into Mr. Baker's office, and the door closed.
"Well, kiss my foot," she said to Joey.
"Prettiest foot in Wessex County," Joey said. "Want to go out tonight? Dance, eat, and all that?"
"Can't," she said.
"Who is that?"
"Never saw him before. Looks like a bank examiner type. It's times like this I'm glad I'm honest, and even gladder I can add and subtract."
"You know, Joey, you're going to make some faithful woman a hell of a fine fugitive."
"That is my prayerful hope, ma'am."
"See you."
She went out, crossed the alley, and entered Marullo's grocery again.
"Hi, Heath."
"Hello, Margie."
"Who was the handsome stranger?"
"Don't you carry a crystal ball?"
"Secret agent?"
"Worse than that. Margie, is everybody afraid of cops? Even if I haven't done anything, I'm scared of cops."
"Was that curly-haired piece of the True Cross a dick?"
"Not exactly. Said he was a federal man."
"What you been up to, Ethan?"
"Up to? Me? Why up to?"
"What did he want?"
"I only know what he asked, but I don't know what he wanted."
"What did he ask?"
"How long do I know my boss? Who else knows him? When did he come to New Baytown?"
"What did you tell him?"
"When I joined up to fight the foe, I didn't know him. When I came back, he was here. When I went broke, he took over the store and gave me a job."
"What do you suppose it's about?"
"God knows."
Margie had been trying to look past his eyes. She thought, "He's pretending to be a simpleton. I wonder what the guy really wanted." He said it so quietly it frightened her.
"You don't believe me."
"You know, Margie, no one ever believes the truth."
"The whole truth?"
"When you carve a chicken, Eve, it's all chicken, but some is dark meat and some white."
"I guess so."
"Frankly, I'm worried, Margie. I need this job. If anything happened to Alfio, I'd be pounding the street."
"Aren't you forgetting you're going to be rich?"
"It's kind of hard to remember when I'm not."
"Ethan, I wonder if you remember back. It was in the spring, right near Easter. I came in and you called me Daughter of Jerusalem."
"That was Good Friday."
"You do remember." "Well, I found it. It's Matthew. And it's pretty wonderful and scary."
"Yes."
"What's got into you?"
"My great-aunt Deborah. She got me crucified once a year. It still goes on."
"You're kidding. You weren't kidding then."
"No, I wasn't, and I'm not now."
She said playfully,
"You know, the fortune I read you is coming true."
"I know it is."
"Don't you think you owe me something?"
"Sure."
"When are you going to pay?"
"Would you care to step into the back room?"
"I don't think you could do it."
"You don't?"
"No, Ethan, and you don't either. You've never had a quick jump in the hay in your life."
"I could learn, maybe."
"You couldn't fornicate if you wanted to."
"I could try."
"It would take love or hatred to arouse you, and either one would require slow and stately procedure."
"Maybe you're right."
"How did you know?" "I never know how I know."
He slid the door of the cold cabinet open, took out a Coke, which instantly grew a jacket of frost, opened it, and handed the bottle to her while he opened a second.
"What is it you want of me?" "I've never known a man like that. Perhaps I want to see what it's like to be loved or hated that much."
"You're a witch. Why don't you whistle up a wind?"
"I can't whistle. I can raise a puny little storm in most men with my eyebrows. How do I go about lighting your fire?"
"Maybe you have."
He studied her closely and did not try to conceal his inspection.
"Built like a brick outhouse," he said. "Soft and smooth and strong and good."
"How do you know? You've never felt me."
"If I ever do, you better run like hell."
"My love."
"Come off it. There's something wrong here. I'm conceited enough to know the caliber of my attractiveness. What do you want? You're a fine broth of a dame, but you're also smart. What do you want?
I told your fortune and it's coming true.
And you want to suck along?
Yes.
Now I can believe you.
He raised his eyes.
Mary of my heart, he said. Look on your husband, your lover, your dear friend. Guard me against evil from within me and from harm without. I pray for your help, my Mary, for a man has a strange and wind-troubled need, and the ache of the ages is on him to spread his seeds everywhere. Ora pro me.
You're a fake, Ethan.
I know it. But can't I be a humble fake?
I'm afraid of you now. I wasn't before.
I can't think why.
She had that tarot look, and he saw it.
Marullo.
What about him?
I'm asking.
Be with you in a moment. Half a dozen eggs, square of butter, right? How are you for coffee? Yes, a can of coffee. I'd like to have it on the shelf. How's that wumptum corned beef hash?
Well, I haven't tried it. They say it's very good. Be with you in a moment, Mr. Baker.
Didn't Mrs. Baker get some of that wumptum corned beef hash?
I don't know, Ethan. I eat what's put before me. Mrs. Young Hunt, you get prettier every day.
Kind, sir.
It's true. And you dress so well.
I was thinking the same about you. Now, you're not pretty, but you have a wonderful tailor.
I guess I have. He charges enough.
Remember the old boy who said, manners maketh man? Well, that's changed now. Tailors make men in any image they want.
The trouble with a well-made suit, it lasts too long. This is 10 years old.
I can't believe it, Mr. Baker. How's Mrs. Baker?
Well enough to complain. Why don't you call on her, Mrs. Young Hunt? She gets lonely. There aren't many people in this generation who can carry on a literate conversation. It was Wickham who said it. It's the motto of Winchester College.
She turned to Ethan. You show me another American banker who knows that.
Mr. Baker grew ruddy. My wife subscribed to great books. She's a great reader. Please call on her.
I'd love to. Put my things in a bag, Mr. Hawley. I'll pick them up on my way home.
Right, ma'am. That's quite a remarkable young woman,
Mr. Baker said. She and Mary hit it off.
Ethan, did that government man come here?
Yes.
What does he want?
I don't know. He asked some questions about Mr. Marullo. I didn't know the answers. Mr. Baker released the image of Margie as slowly as an anemone opens and casts out the shell of a sucked clean crab.
Ethan, have you seen Danny Taylor?
No, I haven't.
Do you know where he is?
No, I don't.
I have to get in touch with him. Can't you think where he might be?
I haven't seen him for, well, since May. He was going to try the cure again.
Do you know where?
He didn't say, but he wanted to try.
Was it a public institution?
I don't think so, sir. He borrowed some money from me.
What?
I loaned him a little money.
How much?
I beg your pardon?
Sorry, Ethan. You're old friends. Sorry. Did he have other money?
I think so.
You don't know how much?
No, sir. I just had a feeling he had more.
If you know where he is, please tell me.
I would if I knew, Mr. Baker. Maybe you could make a list of the places and phone.
Did he borrow cash?
Yes.
Then that's no good. He'd change his name.
Why?
They always do from good families, Ethan. Did you get the money from Mary?
Yes.
She didn't mind?
She didn't know.
Well, now you're being smart.
I learned from you, sir.
Well, don't forget it.
Maybe I'm learning little by little. Mostly I'm learning how much I don't know.
Well, that's healthy. Is Mary well?
Oh, she's strong and tough. Wish I could take her on a little vacation. We haven't been out of town in years.
That will come, Ethan. I think I'll go to Maine over the 4th of July. I can't take the noise anymore.
I guess you bankers are the lucky ones. Weren't you in Albany lately?
What gave you that idea?
I don't know. Heard it someplace. Maybe Mrs. Baker told Mary.
She couldn't. She didn't know it. Try to think where you heard it.
Maybe I only imagined it.
This troubles me, Ethan. Think hard where you heard it.
I can't, sir. What does it matter if it isn't true?
I'll tell you in confidence why I'm worried. It's because it's true. The governor called me in. It's a serious matter. I wonder where the leak could be.
Anyone see you there?
Not that I know of. I flew in and out. This is serious. I'm going to tell you something. If it gets out, I'll know where it came from.
Then I don't want to hear it.
You haven't any choice now that you know about Albany. The state is looking into county and town affairs.
Why?
I guess because the smell has got as far as Albany.
No politics?
I guess anything the governor does can be called politics.
Mr. Baker, why can't it be in the open?
I'll tell you why. Upstate the word got out, and by the time the examiners got to work, most of the records had disappeared.
I see. I wish you hadn't told me. I'm not a talker, but I wish I didn't know.
For that matter, I wish the same thing, Ethan.
The election's July 7th. Will it break before that?
I don't know. That's up to the state.
Do you suppose Marullo's mixed in it? I can't afford to lose my job.
I don't think so. That was a federal man, Department of Justice. Didn't you ask for his credentials?
I didn't think of it. He flashed them, but I didn't look.
Well, you should. You always should.
I wouldn't think you'd want to go away.
Oh, that doesn't matter. Nothing happens over 4th of July weekend. Why, the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor on a weekend. They knew everyone would be away.
I wish I could take my Mary someplace.
Maybe you can later. I want you to whip your brains and try to find where Taylor is.
Why? Is it so important?
It is. I can't tell you why right now.
I sure wish I could find him then.
Well, if you could turn him up, maybe you wouldn't need this job.
If that's the way, I'll sure try, sir.
That's the boy, Ethan. I'm sure you will. And if you do locate him, you call me. Any time. Day or night.
Chapter 13.
I wonder about people who say they haven't time to think. For myself, I can double think. I find that weighing vegetables, passing the time of day with customers, fighting or loving Mary, coping with the children, none of these prevents a second and continuing layer of thinking, wondering, conjecturing. Surely this must be true of everyone. Maybe not having time to think is not having the wish to think. In this strange, uncharted country I had entered, perhaps I had no choice. Questions boiled up, demanding to be noticed. And it was a world so new to me that I puzzled over matters old residents probably solved and put away when they were children. I thought I could put a process in motion and control it at every turn, even stop it when I wanted to. And now the frightening conviction grew in me that such a process may become a thing in itself, a person almost, having its own ends and means, and quite independent of its creator. And another troublesome thought came in. Did I really start it, or did I simply not resist it? I may have been the mover, but was I not also the moved? Once on the long street, there seemed to be no crossroads, no forked paths, no choice. The choice was in the first evaluation. What are morals? Are they simply words? Was it honorable to assess my father's weakness, which was a generous mind and the ill-founded dream that other men were equally generous? No, it was simply good business to dig the pit for him. He fell into it himself. No one pushed him. Was it immoral to strip him when he was down? Apparently not. Now a slow, deliberate encirclement was moving on New Baytown, and it was set in motion by honorable men. If it succeeded, they would be thought not crooked, but clever. And if a factor they had overlooked moved in, would that be immoral or dishonorable? I think that would depend on whether or not it was successful. To most of the world, success is never bad. I remember